upper side. Trantor. It is almost never pictured as a world seen from space. It has long since captured the general mind of humanity as a world of the interior, and the image is that of the human hive that existed under the domes. Yet there was an exterior as well, and there are holographs that still remain that were taken from space and show varying degrees of detail. See figures 14 and 15. Note that the surface of the domes, the interface of the vast city and the overlying atmosphere, a surface referred to in its time as upper side, is Encyclopedia Galactica. 21. Yet the following day found Harry Seldon back in the library. For one thing, there was his promise to Hummin. He had promised to try, and he couldn't very well make it a half-hearted process. For another, he owed something to himself, too. He resented having to admit failure. Not yet, at least. Not while he could plausibly tell himself he was following up leads. So he stared at the list of reference book films he had not yet checked through and tried to decide which of the unappetizing number had the slightest chance of being useful to him. He had about decided that the answer was none of the above and saw no way out but to look at samples of each when he was startled by a gentle tap against the alcove wall. Seldon looked up and found the embarrassed face of Lisung Rhonda peering at him around the edge of the alcove opening. Seldon knew Rhonda, had been introduced to him by Dawes, and had dined with him, and with others, on several occasions. Rhonda, an instructor in psychology, was a little man, short and plump, with a round, cheerful face and an almost perpetual smile. He had a sallow complexion and the narrowed eyes so characteristic of people on millions of worlds. Seldon knew that appearance well, for there were many of the great mathematicians who had borne it, and he had frequently seen their holograms. Yet on Helicon he had never seen one of these Easterners. By tradition they were called that, though no one knew why, and the Easterners themselves were said to resent the term to some degree, but again no one knew why. "There's millions of us here on Trantor," Rhonda had said, smiling with no trace of self-consciousness, when Seldon, on first meeting him, had not been able to repress all trace of startled surprise. "You'll also find lot of Southerners, dark skins, tightly curled hair. Did you ever see one?"
"Not on Helicon," muttered Seldon.
"All Westerners on Helicon, eh? How dull! But it doesn't matter. Takes all kinds."
He left Seldon wondering at the fact that there were Easterners, Southerners, and Westerners, but no Northerners. He had tried finding an answer to why that might be in his reference searches, and had not succeeded. And now Rhonda's good-natured face was looking at him with an almost ludicrous look of concern. He said,
"Are you all right, Seldon?"
Seldon stared.
"Yes, of course. Why shouldn't I be?" "I'm just going by sounds, my friend. You were screaming."
"Screaming?"
Seldon looked at him with offended disbelief. "Not loud. Like this."
Rhonda gritted his teeth and emitted a strangled, high-pitched sound from the back of his throat.
"If I'm wrong, I apologize for this unwarranted intrusion on you. Please forgive me."
Seldon hung his head. "You're forgiven, Lisung. I do make that sound sometimes, I'm told. I assure you, it's unconscious. I'm never aware of it."
"Are you aware why you make it?"
"Yes. Frustration."
"Frustration!"
Rhonda beckoned Seldon closer and lowered his voice further.
"We are disturbing people. Let's come out to the lounge before we're thrown out."
In the lounge, over a pair of mild drinks, Rhonda said,
"May I ask you, as a matter of professional interest, why you are feeling frustration?"
Seldon shrugged. "Why does one usually feel frustration? I'm tackling something in which I am making no progress."
"But you're a mathematician, Harry. Why should anything in the history library frustrate you?"
"What were you doing here?"
"Passing through as part of a shortcut to where I was going when I heard you moaning. Now you see," and he smiled, "it's no longer a shortcut, but a serious delay, one that I welcome, however."
"I wish I were just passing through the history library, but I'm trying to solve a mathematical problem that requires some knowledge of history, and I'm afraid I'm not handling it well." Rhonda stared at Selden with an unusually solemn expression on his face. Then he said, "Pardon me, but I must run the risk of offending you now. I've been computering you." "Computering me?" Selden's eyes widened. He felt distinctly angry. "I have offended you. But you know, I had an uncle who was a mathematician. You might even have heard of him. Kiang Tao Rhonda?" Selden drew in his breath. "Are you a relative of that Rhonda?" "Yes. He is my father's older brother, and he was quite displeased with me for not following in his footsteps. He has no children of his own. I thought somehow that it might please him that I had met a mathematician, and I wanted to boast of you, if I could. So I checked what information the mathematics library might have." "I see. And that's what you were really doing there. Well, I'm sorry. I don't suppose you could do much boasting." "You suppose wrong. I was impressed. I couldn't make heads or tails of the subject matter of your papers, but somehow the information seemed to be very favorable. And when I checked the news files, I found you were at the decennial convention earlier this year. So, what's psychohistory, anyway? Obviously, the first two syllables stir my curiosity." "I see you got that word out of it." "Unless I'm totally misled, it seemed to me that you can work out the future course of history." Selden nodded wearily. "That, more or less, is what psychohistory is, or rather what it is intended to be." "But is it a serious study?" Rhonda was smiling. "You don't just throw sticks?"
"Throw sticks?"
"That's just a reference to a game played by children on my home planet of Hopara. The game is supposed to tell the future, and if you're a smart kid, you can make a good thing out of it. Tell a mother that her child will grow up beautiful and marry a rich man, and it's good for a piece of cake or a half-credit piece on the spot. She isn't going to wait and see if it comes true. You are rewarded just for saying it."
"I see. No, I don't throw sticks. Psychohistory is just an abstract study, strictly abstract. It has no practical application at all, except..."
"Now we're getting to it. Exceptions are what are interesting."
"Except that I would like to work out such an application. Perhaps if I knew more about history."
"Ah, that is why you are reading history?"
"Yes, but it does me no good," said Selden sadly. "There is too much history, and there is too little of it that is told."
"And that's what's frustrating you?"
Selden nodded.
Rhonda said, "But Harry, you've only been here a matter of weeks."
"True, but already I can see."
"You can't see anything in a few weeks. You may have to spend your whole lifetime making one little advance. It may take many generations of work by many mathematicians to make a real inroad on the problem."
"I know that, Lee Sung, but that doesn't make me feel better. I want to make some visible progress myself."
"Well, driving yourself to distraction won't help either. If it will make you feel better, I can give you an example of a subject much less complex than human history that people have been working for I don't know how long without making much progress."
"I know, because a group is working on it right here at the university, and one of my good friends is involved. Talk about frustration. You don't know what frustration is." "What's the subject?" Selden felt a small curiosity stirring within him.
"Meteorology."
"Meteorology?" Selden felt revolted at the anticlimax.
"Don't make faces. Look, every inhabited world has an atmosphere. Every world has its own atmospheric composition, its own temperature range, its own rotation and revolution rate, its own axial tipping, its own land-water distribution. We've got 25 million different problems, and no one has succeeded in finding a generalization."
"That's because atmospheric behavior easily enters a chaotic phase. Everyone knows that."
"So my friend Jenar Lagan says."
"You've met him?" Selden considered.
"Tall fellow, long nose, doesn't speak much?"
"That's the one.
And Trantor itself is a bigger puzzle than almost any world. According to the records, it had a fairly normal weather pattern when it was first settled. Then, as the population grew and urbanization spread, more energy was used and more heat was discharged into the atmosphere. The ice cover contracted, the cloud layer thickened, and the weather got lousier. That encouraged the movement underground and set off a vicious cycle. The worse the weather got, the more eagerly the land was dug into, and the domes built, and the weather got still worse. Now the planet has become a world of almost incessant cloudiness and frequent rains, or snows when it's cold enough. The only thing is that no one can work it out properly. No one has worked out an analysis that can explain why the weather has deteriorated quite as it has, or how one can reasonably predict the details of its day-to-day changes. Selden shrugged. Is that sort of thing important? To a meteorologist it is. Why can't they be as frustrated over their problems as you are over yours? Don't be a project chauvinist. Selden remembered the cloudiness and the dank chill on the way to the Emperor's palace. He said, "So what's being done about it?" "Well, there's a big project on the matter here at the university, and Jennar Lagan is part of it. They feel that if they can understand the weather change on Trantor, they will learn a great deal about the basic laws of general meteorology. Lagan wants that as much as you want your laws of psychohistory. So he has set up an incredible array of instruments of all kinds, upper side, you know, above the domes. It hasn't helped them so far, and if there's so much work being done for many generations on the atmosphere without results, how can you complain that you haven't gotten anything out of human history in a few weeks?" Rhonda was right, Selden thought, and he himself was being unreasonable and wrong. And yet. Hummond would say that this failure in the scientific attack on problems was another sign of the degeneration of the times. Perhaps he was right also, except that he was speaking of a general degeneration and average effect. Selden felt no degeneration of ability and mentality in himself. He said with some interest, then, "You mean that people climb up out of the domes and into the open air above?" "Yes, upper side. It's a funny thing, though. Most native Trantorians won't do it. They don't like to go upper side. The idea gives them vertigo or something. Most of those working on the meteorology project are outworlders." Selden looked out of the window and the lawns and small garden of the university campus, brilliantly lit without shadows or oppressive heat, and said thoughtfully, "I don't know that I can blame Trantorians for liking the comfort of being within, but I should think curiosity would drive some upper side. It would drive me." "Do you mean that you would like to see meteorology in action?" "I think I would. How does one get upper side?" "Nothing to it. An elevator takes you up, a door opens, and there you are. I've been up there. It's novel." "It would get my mind off psychohistory for a while." Selden sighed. "I'd welcome that." "On the other hand," said Rhonda, "my uncle used to say, all knowledge is one, and he may be right. You may learn something from meteorology that will help you with your psychohistory. Isn't that possible?" Selden smiled weakly. "A great many things are possible." And to himself he added, "But not practical." 22. Doris seemed amused. "Meteorology?" Selden said, "Yes. There's work scheduled for tomorrow, and I'll go up with them." "Are you tired of history?" Selden nodded his head somberly. "Yes, I am. I'll welcome the change. Besides, Rhonda says it's another problem that's too massive for mathematics to handle, and it will do me good to see that my situation isn't unique." "I hope you're not agoraphobic." Selden smiled. "No, I'm not, but I see why you ask. Rhonda says the Trantorians are frequently agoraphobic and won't go upper side. I imagine they feel uncomfortable without a protective enclosure." Doris nodded. "You can see where that would be natural. But there are also many Trantorians who are to be found among the planets of the galaxy. Tourists, administrators, soldiers. And agoraphobia isn't particularly rare in the outworlds, either." "That may be, Doris, but I'm not agoraphobic. I am curious, and I welcome the change, so I'll be joining them tomorrow." Doris hesitated. "I should go up with you, but I have a heavy schedule tomorrow." "Still, if you're not agoraphobic, you'll have no trouble, and you'll probably enjoy yourself. Oh, and stay close to the meteorologists. I've heard of people getting lost up there." "I'll be careful. It's a long time since I've gotten truly lost anywhere." 23. Jenar Legan had a dark look about him. It was not so much his complexion, which was fair enough. It was not even his eyebrows, which were thick and dark enough. It was rather that those eyebrows were hunched over deep-set eyes and a long and rather prominent nose. He had, as a result, a most unmerry look. His eyes did not smile, and when he spoke, which wasn't often, he had a deep, strong voice, surprisingly resonant for his rather thin body. He said, "You'll need warmer clothing than that, Selden." Selden said, "Oh?" and looked about. There were two men and two women who were making ready to go up with Legan and Selden, and, as in Legan's own case, their rather satiny Trantorian clothing was covered by thick sweaters that, not surprisingly, were brightly colored in bold designs. No two were even faintly alike, of course. Selden looked down at himself and said, "Sorry, I didn't know, but I don't have any suitable outer garment." "I can give you one. I think there's a spare here somewhere." "Yes, here it is. A little threadbare, but it's better than nothing." "Wearing sweaters like these can make you unpleasantly warm," said Selden. "Here they would," said Legan. "Other conditions exist upper side. Cold and windy. Too bad I don't have spare leggings and boots for you, too. You'll want them later." They were taking with them a cart of instruments, which they were testing one by one with what Selden thought was unnecessary slowness. "Your home planet cold?" asked Legan. Selden said, "Parts of it, of course. The part of Helicon I come from is mild and often rainy." "Too bad. You won't like the weather upper side." "I think I can manage to endure it for the time we'll be up there." When they were ready, the group filed into an elevator that was marked "Official Use Only." "That's because it goes upper side," said one of the young women, "and people aren't supposed to be up there without good reason." Selden had not met the young woman before, but he had heard her addressed as Clausia. He didn't know if that was a first name, a last name, or a nickname. The elevator seemed no different from others that Selden had been on, either here on Trantor or at home in Helicon, barring, of course, the gravitic lift he and Hummin had used. But there was something about knowing that it was going to take him out of the confines of the planet and into emptiness above that made it feel like a spaceship. Selden smiled internally, a foolish fantasy. The elevator quivered slightly, which reminded Selden of Hummin's forebodings of galactic decay. Legan, along with the other men and one of the women, seemed frozen and waiting, as though they had suspended thought as well as activity until they could get out, but Clausia kept glancing at him as though she found him terribly impressive. Selden leaned close and whispered to her. He hesitated to disturb the others. "Are we going up very high?" "High?" she repeated. She spoke in a normal voice, apparently not feeling that the others required silence. She seemed very young, and it occurred to Selden that she was probably an undergraduate. An apprentice, perhaps. "We're taking a long time. Upper side must be many stories high in the air." For a moment she looked puzzled. Then, "Oh no, not high at all. We started very deep. The university is at a low level. We use a great deal of energy, and if we're quite deep, the energy costs are lower." Legan said, "All right, we're here. Let's get the equipment out." The elevator stopped with a small shudder, and the wide door slid open rapidly. The temperature dropped at once, and Selden thrust his hands into his pockets and was very glad he had a sweater on. The cold wind stirred his hair, and it occurred to him that he would have found a hat useful, and, even as he thought that, Legan pulled something out of a fold in his sweater, snapped it open, and put it on his head. The others did the same. Only Clausia hesitated. She paused just before she put hers on, then offered it to Selden. Selden shook his head. "I can't take your hat, Clausia." "Go ahead. I have long hair, and it's pretty thick. Yours is short and a little thin." Selden would have liked to deny that firmly, and at another time he would have. Now, however, he took the hat and mumbled, "Thank you. If your head gets cold, I'll give it back." Maybe she wasn't so young. It was her round face, almost a baby face, and now that she had called attention to her hair, he could see that it was a charming russet shade. He had never seen hair quite like that on Helicon. Outside it was cloudy, as it had been the time he was taken across open country to the palace. It was considerably colder than it had been then, but he assumed that was because they were 6 weeks farther into winter. The clouds were thicker than they had been on the earlier occasion, and the day was distinctly darker and threatening. Or was it just closer to night? Surely they wouldn't come up to do important work without leaving themselves an ample period of daylight to do it in. Or did they expect to take very little time? He would have liked to have asked, but it occurred to him that they might not like questions at this time. All of them seemed to be in states varying from excitement to anger. Selden inspected his surroundings. He was standing on something that he thought might be dull metal from the sound it made when he surreptitiously thumped his foot down on it. It was not bare metal, however. When he walked, he left footprints. The surface was clearly covered by dust or fine sand or clay. Well, why not? There could scarcely be anyone coming up here to dust the place. He bent down to pinch up some of the matter out of curiosity. Clausia had come up to him. She noticed what he was doing and said, with the air of a housewife caught in an embarrassing negligence, "We do sweep hereabouts for the sake of the instruments. It's much worse most places, Upperside, but it really doesn't matter. It makes for insulation, you know." Selden grunted and continued to look about. There was no chance of understanding the instruments that looked as though they were growing out of the thin soil, if one could call it that. He hadn't the faintest idea of what they were or what they measured. Legan was walking toward him. He was picking up his feet and putting them down gingerly, and it occurred to Selden that he was doing so to avoid jarring the instruments. He made a mental note to walk that way himself. "You, Selden." Selden didn't quite like the tone of voice. He replied coolly, "Yes, Dr. Legan." "Well, Dr. Selden, then." He said it impatiently. "That little fellow Rhonda told me you were a mathematician."
"That's right."
"A good one?"
"I'd like to think so, but it's a hard thing to guarantee."
"And you're interested in intractable problems?"
Selden said feelingly, "I'm stuck with one."
"I'm stuck with another. You're free to look about. If you have any questions, our intern, Clausia, will help out. You might be able to help us."
"I would be delighted to, but I know nothing about meteorology."
"That's all right, Selden. I just want you to get a feel for this thing, and then I'd like to discuss my mathematics, such as it is."
"I'm at your service."
Legan turned away, his long scowling face looking grim. Then he turned back. "If you get cold, too cold, the elevator door is open. You just step in and touch the spot marked University Base. It will take you down, and the elevator will then return to us automatically. Clausia will show you, if you forget."
"I won't forget."
This time he did leave, and Selden looked after him, feeling the cold wind knife through his sweater. Clausia came back over to him, her face slightly reddened by that wind. Selden said,
"Dr. Legan seems annoyed, or is that just his ordinary outlook on life?"
She giggled.
"He does look annoyed most of the time, but right now he really is."
Selden said very naturally,
"Why?"
Clausia looked over her shoulder, her long hair swirling. Then she said,
"I'm not supposed to know, but I do just the same. Dr. Legan had it all figured out that today, just at this time, there was going to be a break in the clouds, and he'd been planning to make special measurements in sunlight. Only, well, look at the weather."
Selden nodded.
"We have holovision receivers up here, so he knew it was cloudy, worse than usual, and I guess he was hoping there would be something wrong with the instruments, so that it would be their fault and not that of his theory. So far, though, they haven't found anything out of the way."
"And that's why he looks so unhappy?"
"Well, he never looks happy."
Selden looked about, squinting. Despite the clouds, the light was harsh. He became aware that the surface under his feet was not quite horizontal. He was standing on a shallow dome, and as he looked outward, there were other domes in all directions, with different widths and heights.
"Upperside seems to be irregular," he said. "Mostly, I think. That's the way it worked out."
"Any reason for it?"
"Not really. The way I've heard it explained,"
I looked around and asked, just as you did, you know,
"was that originally the people on Trantor domed in places,
shopping malls, sports arenas, things like that. Then whole towns, so that there were lots of domes here and there, with different heights and different widths. When they all came together, it was all uneven, but by that time people decided that's the way it ought to be. You mean that something quite accidental came to be viewed as a tradition?
I suppose so, if you want to put it that way.
If something quite accidental can easily become viewed as a tradition and be made unbreakable, or nearly so, thought Selden, would that be a law of psychohistory? It sounded trivial, but how many other laws, equally trivial, might there be? A million? A billion? Were there a relatively few general laws from which these trivial ones could be derived as corollaries? How could he say? For a while, lost in thought, he almost forgot the biting wind. Clausia was aware of that wind, however, for she shuddered and said, "It's very nasty. It's much better under the dome."
"Are you a Trantorian?" asked Selden.
"That's right."
Selden remembered Rhonda's dismissal of Trantorians as agoraphobic and said, "Do you mind being up here?"
"I hate it," said Clausia. "But I want my degree and my specialty and status, and Dr. Legan says I can't get it without some field work. So here I am, hating it, especially when it's so cold. When it's this cold, by the way, you wouldn't dream that vegetation actually grows on these domes, would you?"
"It does?" He looked at Clausia sharply, suspecting some sort of practical joke designed to make him look foolish. She looked totally innocent, but how much of that was real and how much was just her baby face?
"Oh, sure, even here when it's warmer. You notice the soil here? We keep it swept away because of our work, as I said, but in other places it accumulates here and there and is especially deep in the low places where the domes meet. Plants grow in it."
"But where does the soil come from?"
"When the dome covered just part of the planet, the wind deposited soil on them little by little. Then, when Trantor was all covered and the living levels were dug deeper and deeper, some of the material dug up, if suitable, would be spread over the top."
"Surely it would break down the domes."
"Oh, no. The domes are very strong, and they're supported almost everywhere. The idea was, according to a book film I viewed, that they were going to grow crops upperside, but it turned out to be much more practical to do it inside the dome. Yeast and algae could be cultivated within the domes, too, taking the pressure off the usual crops, so it was decided to let upperside go wild. There are animals on upperside, too. Butterflies, bees, mice, rabbits, lots of them."
"Won't the plant roots damage the domes?"
"In thousands of years, they haven't. The domes are treated so that they repel the roots. Most of the growth is grass, but there are trees, too. You'd be able to see for yourself if this were the warm season, or if we were farther south, or if you were up in a spaceship."
She looked at him with a sidewise flick of her eyes.
"Did you see Trantor when you were coming down from space?"
"No, Clausia, I must confess I didn't. The hypership was never well placed for viewing. Have you ever seen Trantor from space?"
She smiled weakly.
"I've never been in space."
Selden looked about, gray everywhere.
"I can't make myself believe it," he said. "About vegetation, upperside, I mean."
"It's true, though. I've heard people say, other worlders like yourself who did see Trantor from space, that the planet looks green, like a lawn, because it's mostly grass and underbrush. There are trees, too, actually. There's a copse not very far from here. I've seen it. They're evergreens, and they're up to 6 meters high."
"Where?"
"You can't see it from here. It's on the other side of a dome. It's..."
The call came out thinly. Selden realized they had been walking while they had been talking and had moved away from the immediate vicinity of the others.
"Clausia, get back here. We need you."
Clausia said, "Uh-oh."
"Coming!"
"Sorry, Dr. Selden, I have to go."
She ran off, managing to step lightly despite her lined boots. Had she been playing with him? Had she been filling the gullible foreigner with a mess of lies for amusement's sake? Such things had been known to happen on every world and in every time. An air of transparent honesty was no guide either. In fact, successful tale-tellers would deliberately cultivate just such an air. So could there really be 6-meter trees upperside? Without thinking much about it, he moved in the direction of the highest dome on the horizon. He swung his arms in an attempt to warm himself, and his feet were getting cold. Clausia hadn't pointed. She might have, to give him a hint of the direction of the trees, but she didn't. Why didn't she? To be sure, she had been called away. The domes were broad rather than high, which was a good thing, since otherwise the going would have been considerably more difficult. On the other hand, the gentle grade meant trudging a distance before he could top a dome and look down the other side. Eventually, he could see the other side of the dome he had climbed. He looked back to make sure he could still see the meteorologists and their instruments. They were a good way off, in a distant valley, but he could see them clearly enough. Good. He saw no cops, no trees, but there was a depression that snaked about between two domes. Along each side of that crease, the soil was thicker, and there were occasional green smears of what might be moss. If he followed the crease, and if it got low enough and the soil was thick enough, there might be trees. He looked back, trying to fix landmarks in his mind, but there were just the rise and fall of domes. It made him hesitate, and Dorza's warning against his being lost, which had seemed a rather unnecessary piece of advice then, made more sense now. Still, it seemed clear to him that the crease was a kind of road. If he followed it for some distance, he only had to turn about and follow it back to return to this spot. He strode off purposefully, following the rounded crease downward. There was a soft rumbling noise above, but he didn't give it any thought. He had made up his mind that he wanted to see trees, and that was all that occupied him at the moment. The moss grew thicker and spread out like a carpet, and here and there grassy tufts had sprung up. Despite the desolation upper side, the moss was bright green, and it occurred to Selden that on a cloudy, overcast planet there was likely to be considerable rain. The crease continued to curve, and there, just above another dome, was a dark smudge against the gray sky, and he knew he had found the trees. Then, as though his mind, having been liberated by the sight of those trees, could turn to other things, Selden took note of the rumble he had heard before, and had without thinking dismissed as the sound of machinery. Now he considered that possibility. Was it indeed the sound of machinery? Why not? He was standing on one of the myriad domes that covered hundreds of millions of square kilometers of the world city. There must be machinery of all kinds hidden under those domes, ventilation motors for one thing. Maybe it could be heard, where and when all the other sounds of the world city were absent. Except that it did not seem to come from the ground. He looked up at the dreary feature of the sky. Nothing. He continued to scan the sky, vertical creases appearing between his eyes, and then, far off, there was a small dark spot showing up against the gray, and whatever it was, it seemed to be moving about as though getting its bearings before it was obscured by the clouds again. Then, without knowing why, he thought, "They're after me." And almost before he could work out a line of action, he had taken one. He ran desperately along the crease toward the trees, and then, to reach them more quickly, he turned left and hurtled up and over a low dome, treading through brown and dying fern-like overgrowth, including thorny sprigs with bright red berries. 24. Selden panted, facing a tree, holding it closely, embracing it. He watched for the flying object to make its appearance again so that he could back about the tree and hide on the far side like a squirrel. The tree was cold, its bark was rough. It gave no comfort, but it offered cover. Of course, that might be insufficient, if he was being searched for with a heat-seeker, but on the other hand, the cold trunk of a tree might blur even that. Below him was hard-packed soil. Even in this moment of hiding, of attempting to see his pursuer while remaining unseen, he could not help wondering how thick the soil might be, how long it had taken to accumulate, how many domes in the warmer areas of Trantor carried forests on their back, and whether the trees were always confined to the creases between domes, leaving the higher regions to moss, grass, and underbrush. He saw it again. It was not a hypership, nor even an ordinary air jet. It was a jet down. He could see the faint glow of the ion trails coming out at the vertices of a hexagon, neutralizing the gravitational pull and allowing the wings to keep it aloft like a large soaring bird. It was a vehicle that could hover and explore a planetary terrain. It was only the clouds that had saved him. Even if they were using heat-seekers, that would only indicate there were people below. The jet down would have to make a tentative dive below the banked ceiling before it could hope to know how many human beings there were, and whether any of them might be the particular person the parties aboard were seeking. The jet down was closer now, but it couldn't hide from him either. The rumble of the engine gave it away, and they couldn't turn that off, not as long as they wished to continue their search. Selden knew the jet downs, for on Helicon, or on any undomed world with skies that cleared now and then, they were common, with many in private hands. Of what possible use would jet downs be on Trantor, with all the human life of the world under domes, with low cloud ceilings all but perpetual, except for a few government vehicles designed for just this purpose, that of picking up a wanted person who had been lured above the domes? Why not? Government forces could not enter the grounds of the university, but perhaps Selden was no longer on the grounds. He was on top of the domes, which might be outside the jurisdiction of any local government. An imperial vehicle might have every right to land on any part of the dome and question or remove any person found upon it. Hummin had not warned him of this, but perhaps he had merely not thought of doing so. The jet down was even closer now, nosing about like a blind beast sniffing out its prey. Would it occur to them to search this group of trees? Would they land and send out an armed soldier or two to beat through the copse? And if so, what could he do? He was unarmed, and all his quick-twist agility would be useless against the agonizing pain of a neuronic whip. It was not attempting to land. Either they missed the significance of the trees, or a new thought suddenly hit him. What if this wasn't a pursuit vessel at all? What if it was part of the meteorological testing? Surely meteorologists would want to test the upper reaches of the atmosphere. Was he a fool to hide from it? The sky was getting darker. The clouds were getting thicker, or much more likely, night was falling. And it was getting colder, and would get colder still. Was he going to stay out here freezing because a perfectly harmless jet down had made an appearance and had activated a sense of paranoia that he had never felt before? He had a strong impulse to leave the copse and get back to the meteorological station. After all, how would the man Hummin feared so much, Demerzel, know that Selden would at this particular time be upper side and ready to be taken? For a moment that seemed conclusive, and shivering with the cold, he moved out from behind the tree. And then he scurried back as the vessel reappeared even closer than before. He hadn't seen it do anything that would seem to be meteorological. It did nothing that might be considered sampling, measuring, or testing. Would he see such things if they took place? He did not know the precise sort of instruments the jet down carried or how they worked. If they were doing meteorological work, he might not be able to tell. Still, could he take the chance of coming into the open? After all, what if Demerzel did know of his presence upper side, simply because an agent of his, working in the university, knew about it, and had reported the matter? Isung Randa, that cheerful, smiling little Easterner, had suggested he go upper side. He had suggested it quite forcefully, and the subject had not arisen naturally out of the conversation, at least not naturally enough. Was it possible that he was a government agent, and had alerted Demerzel somehow? Then there was Legan, who had given him the sweater. The sweater was useful, but why hadn't Legan told him he would need one earlier so he could get his own? Was there something special about the one he was wearing? It was uniformly purple, while all the others indulged in the Trantorian fashion of bright patterns. Anyone looking down from a height would see a moving dull blotch in among others that were bright, and know immediately whom they wanted. And Clausia? She was supposedly upper side to learn meteorology and help the meteorologists. How was it possible that she could come to him, talk to him at ease, and quietly walk him away from the others and isolate him so that he could easily be picked up? For that matter, what about Doris Venabili? She knew he was going upper side. She did not stop it. She might have gone with him, but she was conveniently busy. It was a conspiracy. Surely it was a conspiracy. He had convinced himself now, and there was no further thought of getting out from the shelter of the trees. His feet felt like lumps of ice, and stamping them against the ground seemed to do no good. Would the jet down never leave? And even as he thought that, the pitch of the engine's rumble heightened, and the jet down rose into the clouds and faded away. Selden listened eagerly, alert to the smallest sound, making sure it was finally gone. And then, even after he was sure it was gone, he wondered if that was just a device to flush him out of hiding. He remained where he was while the minutes slowly crawled on and night continued to fall. And finally, when he felt that the true alternative to taking the chance of coming out in the open was that of freezing into insensibility, he stepped out and moved cautiously beyond the shelter of the trees. It was dusky twilight, after all. They couldn't detect him except by a heat-seeker, but if so, he would hear the jet down return. He waited just beyond the trees, counting to himself, ready to hide in the copse again at the smallest sound, though what good that would do him once he was spotted he couldn't imagine. Selden looked about. If he could find the meteorologists, they would surely have artificial light, but except for that, there would be nothing. He could still just make out his surroundings, but in a matter of a quarter of an hour, half an hour at the outside, he would not. With no lights and a cloudy sky above, it would be dark, completely dark. Desperate at the prospect of being enveloped in total darkness, Selden realized that he would have to find his way back to the crease that had brought him there as quickly as possible and retrace his steps. Folding his arms tightly around himself for warmth, he set off in what he thought was the direction of the crease between the domes. There might, of course, be more than one crease leading away from the copse, but he dimly made out some of the sprigs of berries he had seen coming in, which now looked almost black rather than bright red. He could not delay. He had to assume he was right. He moved up the crease as fast as he might, guided by failing sight and by the vegetation underfoot. But he couldn't stay in the crease forever. He had come over what had seemed to him to be the tallest dome in sight, and had found a crease that cut at right angles across his line of approach. By his reckoning, he should now turn right, then sharp left, and that would put him on the path toward the meteorologist's dome. Selden made the left turn, and, lifting his head, he could just make out the curve of a dome against the fractionally lighter sky. That had to be it. Or was that only wishful thinking? He had no choice but to assume it wasn't. Keeping his eye on the peak so that he could move in a reasonably straight line, he headed for it as quickly as he could. As he got closer, he could make out the line of dome against sky with less and less certainty as it loomed larger and larger. Soon, if he was correct, he would be going up a gentle slope, and when that slope became level, he would be able to look down the other side and see the lights of the meteorologists. In the inky dark, he could not tell what lay in his path. Wishing there were at least a few stars to shed some light, he wondered if this was how it felt to be blind. He waved his arms before him as if they were antennae. It was growing colder by the minute, and he paused occasionally to blow on his hands and hold them under his armpits. He wished earnestly he could do the same for his feet. By now, he thought, if it started to precipitate, it would be snow, or worse yet, sleet. On, on. There was nothing else to do. Eventually, it seemed to him that he was moving downward. That was either wishful thinking, or he had topped the dome. He stopped. If he had topped the dome, he should be able to see the artificial light of the meteorological station. He would see the lights carried by the meteorologists themselves, sparkling or dancing like fireflies. Selden closed his eyes as though to accustom them to dark, and then try again, but that was a foolish effort. It was no darker with his eyes closed than with them open, and when he opened them it was no lighter than when he had had them closed. Possibly Legan and the others were gone, had taken their lights with them, and had turned off any lights on the instruments. Or possibly Selden had climbed the wrong dome, or he had followed a curved path along the dome so that he was now facing in the wrong direction. Or he had followed the wrong crease and had moved away from the copse in the wrong direction altogether. What should he do? If he was facing the wrong direction, there was a chance that light would be visible right or left, and it wasn't. If he had followed the wrong crease, there was no possible way he could return to the copse and locate a different crease. His only chance lay in the assumption that he was facing the right direction, and that the meteorological station was more or less directly ahead of him, but that the meteorologists had gone and had left it in darkness. Move forward, then. The chances of success might be small, but it was the only chance he had. He estimated that it had taken him half an hour to move from the meteorological station to the top of the dome, having gone part way with Clausia and sauntering with her rather than striding. He was moving at little better than a saunter now in the daunting darkness. Selden continued to slog forward. It would have been nice to know the time, and he had a time band, of course, but in the dark, he stopped. He wore a Trantorian time band, which gave Galactic Standard time, as all time bands did, and which also gave Trantorian local time. Time bands were usually visible in the dark, phosphorescing so that one could tell time in the quiet dark of a bedchamber. A Heliconian time band certainly would. Why not a Trantorian one? He looked at his time band with reluctant apprehension and touched the contacts that would draw upon the power source for light. The time band gleamed feebly and told him the time was 1847. For it to be nighttime already, Selden knew that it must be the winter season. How far past the solstice was it? What was the degree of axial tipping? How long was the year? How far from the equator was he at this moment? There was no hint of an answer to any of these things, but what counted was that the spark of light was visible. He was not blind. Somehow the feeble glow of his time band gave him renewed hope. His spirits rose. He would move on in the direction he was going. He would move for half an hour. If he encountered nothing, he would move on 5 minutes more, no further, just 5 minutes. If he still encountered nothing, he would stop and think. That, however, would be 35 minutes from now. Till then, he would concentrate only on walking and on willing himself to feel warmer. He wiggled his toes vigorously. He could still feel them. Selden trudged onward, and the half hour passed. He paused, then hesitantly he moved on for 5 more minutes. Now he had to decide. There was nothing. He might be nowhere, far removed from any opening into the dome. He might, on the other hand, be standing 3 meters to the left, or right, or short, of the meteorological station. He might be 2 arms' lengths from the opening into the dome, which would not, however, be open. Now what? Was there any point in shouting? He was enveloped by utter silence, but for the whistling of the wind. If there were birds, beasts, or insects in among the vegetation on the domes, they were not here during this season, or at this time of night, or at this particular place. The wind continued to chill him. Perhaps he should have been shouting all the way. The sound might have carried a good distance in the cold air, but would there have been anyone to hear him? Would they hear him inside the dome? Were there instruments to detect sound or movement from above? Might there not be sentinels just inside? That seemed ridiculous. They would have heard his footsteps, wouldn't they? Still, he called out, "Help! Help! Can someone hear me?" His cry was strangled, half embarrassed. It seemed silly, shouting into vast black nothingness. But then he felt it was even sillier to hesitate in such a situation as this. Panic was welling up in him. He took in a deep, cold breath and screamed for as long as he could. Another breath and another scream, changing pitch, and another. Selden paused, breathless, turning his head every which way, even though there was nothing to see. He could not even detect an echo. There was nothing left to do but wait for the dawn. But how long was the night at this season of the year, and how cold would it get? He felt a tiny cold touch sting his face. After a while, another. It was sleeting invisibly in the pitch blackness, and there was no way to find shelter. He thought, it would have been better if that jet down had seen me and picked me up. I would be a prisoner at this moment, perhaps, but I'd be warm and comfortable at least. Or if Hummin had never interfered, I might have been back in Helicon long ago, under surveillance, but warm and comfortable. Right now, that was all he wanted, to be warm and comfortable. But at the moment, he could only wait. He huddled down, knowing that however long the night, he dared not sleep. He slipped off his shoes and rubbed his icy feet. Quickly, he put his shoes back on. He knew he would have to repeat this, as well as rubbing his hands and ears all night long to keep his circulation flowing. But most important to remember was that he must not let himself fall asleep. That would mean certain death. And having carefully thought all this out, his eyes closed and he nodded off to sleep, with the sleet coming down.